Okay. But I didn't give him any warning. The story is told of a young fellow who wanted to be a star journalist, but he lived in a small town, so there was not much possibility for exciting news that he could report on and become noticed. But one day, a dam upstream broke, the town was flooded, and sensing an opportunity, he got in his rowboat and he headed out looking for his big story. He found a lady sitting on a rooftop, so he rowed to the house, he tied up the boat, and he got on the roof with her, and he told her what he was after. And they sat on the flooded roof, and watched as various items floated by. Maybe there'd be a story somewhere in the flood. And as something would float by, the lady would say, "Now there's a story." And the young man would say, "No, that's not a story." And this happened several times. And finally, they look out, and a hat floats by. And it goes a ways, and then it turns around, does a 180, and it comes back up the river. And then it turns a 180, and it goes back down a river. And the young man says, "Now that's a story." And the woman replies, "Oh, no, that's not a story. That's my husband, Hayford. He said he was going to mow the lawn come hell or high water." As determined as that young man was to get a story, I think Hayford was more determined to mow the lawn. This year, as I continue in a theme of sermons here today, the youth camp theme was leaders, people of character. As I've mentioned previously, I think this is a great theme, and not just for the teens at summer camp. I think this is a great theme. I like this theme because it gets into specifics of the type of leader, type of Christian God is looking for. The world doesn't look for the same leadership that God does. They look for carnal leaders. They won't put it that way, but they look for individuals who can be an industry leader, who can generate a healthy stream of income for the investors, or can squeeze the most out of their vendors or employees. This type of leadership is effective in the short term, but it's essentially selfish. God expects us to be leaders who reflect His nature, His character, not the world's expectation of leadership. And this type of character is being lost in the culture around us. And I personally believe when it is truly lost, then this nation is going to pay a great price. Commitment, integrity, determination, courage, and vision are core values of godly character. And while these characteristics can be seen in some, they're lost in most. To go back to our definition of character as a reminder, character can be defined as knowing right from wrong, whether it's physically or morally or spiritually, and then doing the right thing. In the first sermon of this series, we looked at the component of commitment in godly character. Last week, we added the value of integrity. And today, we're going to continue the series covering these five aspects of character. And the third part of that godly character then is determination. Determination. What does it mean to have determination? Was it that young man looking for a story? Was it Hayward trying to mow the lawn no matter what? Determination is having purpose to accomplish right goals. Purpose to accomplish right goals regardless of the obstacles or opposition. That goal, according to the godly character that we're talking about today, has to be based on the morally and spiritually right things to begin with. But why is this important? Why does a leader need to have determination? Well, quite frankly, determination separates the doers from the dreamers. There's an old expression I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It simply says, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." And there are a lot of people out there with good intentions, but not everybody is following through on it. One of the very curious things is this matter of determination oftentimes makes up and surpasses even talent. There was a young fellow I knew when I was in high school, very intelligent when it came to certain hard things, math, chemistry, sciences, and so forth. When it came to life, he was as dumb as a rock. He couldn't function outside of a classroom. And I'll give you an example of how this happened. He sat one time talking with his friends, and he wanted to play his radio, so he had his car on. He sat there talking so long to his friends, he ran out of gas. Parked. intentions are not good enough. We have to know what is right, know what that character is, and then put those things into actions. And there are many who dream of accomplishing great things. Look at high school. Many people start out with just wonderful intentions of what their life is going to be. But how many actually accomplish those things? How many willing to sacrifice what is required to do those great things? To better consider the component of godly character that is determination today, we're going to look at the biblical example of Nehemiah, if you want to begin turning there with me. Nehemiah's story is one of courage and wisdom, discernment, and determination. He demonstrated great leadership through this determination in the face of great odds. To set the stage a little bit as you're turning there, Nehemiah was out of the captivity of Judah during the time of the rule of Persia. And Nehemiah's story begins somewhere in the year, probably around 445 BC, in the winter time. We know it was the winter because it mentions the residence of the king of Persia, Artaxerxes, and that town was where he stayed in the winter time. Around this time, some 54,000 Jews had returned earlier with Joshua and Zerubbabel from Babylon when Babylon fell. They were freed to go back home, and when Joshua and Zerubbabel went back to Jerusalem, they rebuilt the temple. They rebuilt some of the city, and that story is recorded in the book of Ezra. Ezra had left Persia for Jerusalem around 458 BC. This is about 12 years before the story of Nehemiah that we're going to pick up here. Ezra went back with a much smaller group. It was only about 1,700 or so people. As we begin in Nehemiah 1, we find that Nehemiah is what's called a cupbearer for the king. This was not just a matter of being a waiter, somebody that fetched his wine. It was a bigger responsibility than that. The cupbearer was responsible to make sure that the king's food and wine was not poisoned. Now, how do you do that? You taste it. If you die, the king knows not to eat it or drink it. All right, well, it wasn't just a matter of chance. Part of what that person was supposed to do was to pay attention to the food, pay attention how it was prepared, to watch over it, to have the wine under lock, perhaps, or under guard, to make sure that it wasn't compromised. It was a proactive situation, if you will. And so he would test it in the presence, that is, taste it, so the king could see and be reassured that it was safe. And so then we pick up the story in verse 2 of chapter 1. Here it says that Hananiah, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. So some of those that had gone back to Judah came back to the kingdom of Persia, and they see Nehemiah. And so Nehemiah says, I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And this is their report. They said to me, the survivors who are left in the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, or we might more accurately say still broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. Why is this important? Well, without the walls, without the gates, the city's vulnerable to animals, to outside attack. We'll see some of that in a moment. It leaves them without any protection. So notice verse 4. So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and I wept. He cried. He cried for the people. He cried for their distress. He says, and mourned for many days. This was not just a passing disappointment. This truly hurt him to know these people were in such hard straits. He says, I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. He took it to God. And this is one of the first examples we see here of how we can emulate this determination. Nehemiah begins to consider the situation by taking it to God. We pick up the story in verse 5, so then he says, he prayed, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments. See, there's the component of not only knowing what's right, but doing what is right. He says, we do that. Please let your ear be attentive, your eyes open, that you hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel. This is another component. A good leader is concerned about other people before himself. Nehemiah is praying for the people here, not for himself. He says, "The children of Israel, your servant, confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you, both my father, house, and I." He's not making any pretense here, saying, well, they're all terrible people, but please be merciful to them. I know that I have your favor. I know I'm good before your sight. He puts himself in the same class, if you will. Verse 7, "We've acted very corruptly against you and not kept the commandments," that is, previously, to bring them into captivity. But he says to God, "Remember, I pray, the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are faithful, I will scatter you among the nations." I'm sorry, if you are unfaithful. "But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast to the furthest parts of heaven, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place that I've chosen." So he claims a promise here. He says, "Now these are your servants, your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, and let your servant prosper this day." Now, he's got something very specific in mind here. This is not a general request that his life go well. He's bringing this request, remember, because of the distress of the people. What we find next is that Nehemiah brings a petition before the king, but he had to be very careful in how he did this. He's not the king's confidant. He's not an advisor. He's the cupbearer. He's of the staff, if you will. He was there to serve the king, not to have the king concerned with his concerns. And so in chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "It came to pass at the beginning of the year, the month of Nisan, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine, gave it to the king, and I'd never been sad in his presence." That was not his right. They were supposed to please the king. So he says, "The king noticed and said to me, 'Why is your face sad since you're not sick?'" The king knew something was different. "There is nothing but sorrow of heart." Something's on your mind. Now, did he, Nehemiah, get concerned here? Because this could go a couple of different ways here. What if the king got mad, dismissed him, or punished him more severely? As he says, "I became dreadfully afraid, and I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire?'" Now, back up in verse 11, the previous chapter, he'd asked God to prosper him. So he seems to take, if you will, the bull by the horns here, in for a penny, in for a pound. He's going to make his request. The king realizes that's what he's asking. And then so in verse 4, "The king said to me, 'What do you request?'" Huge favor. God answered the prayer in verse 11 to prosper them. The simple fact of the matter that Artaxerxes said, "What can I do to help?" is huge. And so then, verse 5, Nehemiah says to the king, "If it pleases, and if I, your servant, have found favor in your sight, I ask you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tomb, that I may rebuild it." Now this is the cupbearer. This is somebody the king has come to trust. He has no reason to send him back to his homeland, except that Nehemiah has been given favor here. From God, from his hard work, from both. And so then, verse 6, they ask, "How long is your journey going to be? When are you going to return?" "So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time." Okay, it's not an open-ended thing. To go back to Jerusalem, maybe I'll come back. We're not told how long he said, but they set a time. "I'm going to go away, I'll take care of these things, and then I'll be back." So then he continues, verse 7, he asks the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass." He wanted those that he would encounter to know that he was not usurping the king here. He was not going to create a rebellion, that he would have safe passage back to Jerusalem. And so then he also asks, verse 8, for the keeper of the king's forests to give him timber. So he got letters to get material to take to Jerusalem as well, to help in the rebuilding. And at the end of verse 8 there it says, "The king granted me according to the good hand of my God that was upon me." Nehemiah knew where this was coming from. Did you notice, though, earlier, we kind of skipped over it, the end of verse 4, Nehemiah's instant prayer. See, there are times when that's all we have. We need to make sure the stage is set before that, though. Back in chapter 1, Nehemiah spent time in prayer and fasting. And when the king asked the question, he didn't say, wait a minute, go to his closet, come back 20 minutes later. Okay, now let me answer your question. In his mind, he quickly asked God to show him favor, as he asked earlier that the king would be favorable here. But he had trust and confidence in God as well. Let's continue in verse 9. So then Nehemiah says, I went to the governors in the region beyond the river, gave them the king's letters. The king had sent captains of the army and the horsemen with me. He even sent protection to go with Nehemiah. Verse 11, and when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Now, these are rulers near Judah. They were not pleased at this change in events. We'll come back to that thought here in a little bit. But Nehemiah has been given leave by King Artaxerxes, and within a short time then, he collects his supplies and he arrives in Jerusalem. And what would you expect a leader to do first? Again, we're talking about a leader that God would recognize. Would you simply jump in and start making decisions? Making a list of demands, you know, go do this, take care of that, whatever? Would it be to make sure your office was taken care of first? Well, let me get established, you know, and make this fine presence known in the town. Or would it be to make a series of public speeches telling everyone, I'm in charge now, everything's going to be okay? Well, let's look in verse 11. Nehemiah says, I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. 3 days. He did what would, from the outside looking in, look like nothing. He says, I arose at the night, I and a few men with me, a couple of men that he could trust. In the middle of the night, I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal except with me except the one I rode on. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well, the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned with fire. He went out quietly, without any fanfare. He wanted to assess the situation before anything was started. He spent 3 days surveying, if you will, the state of affairs. Nehemiah knew what his purpose was. As it says there, he says, what God had put in my heart. He knew what he was going to do, but he was making sure that he was going to do it the right way. And so then to move down to verse 17, he says to these officials, you see the distress that we are in. He's not telling them anything they don't know. He says, how Jerusalem lies waste, its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach, to show that God's presence is back in that city. And I told them of the hand of my God which had been good upon me, and also the king's words which he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. And so they set their hands to do this good work. Now, remember what I mentioned earlier concerning the time period. Joshua and Zerubbabel had left decades earlier. Decades. The walls are still not rebuilt. The gates aren't even repaired. Nothing much has changed. Nehemiah shows up and says, we need to address this. This needs to be taken care of. But all was not smooth sailing just because Nehemiah shows up. Not, you know, even though because he has the king's letters, that's not automatically going to change things. Remember those critics we read about earlier? Well, they're still there. They're back now, and what they begin to do is focus on harassing Nehemiah. And the reason they do that is because they don't want the walls rebuilt. They don't want Jerusalem to be self-sufficient and protected. They want them to be vulnerable. They want to be able to control the situation. So Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, they were all in on this. Those are names as we read the story here in verse 19. It says they laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you're doing? Will you rebel against the king?" Evidently, they hadn't even paid attention to know that Nehemiah had a letter from the king. There was no rebellion involved. But again, they didn't really care. They were trying to keep the status quo. Nehemiah was upsetting their plans. And I'm sure that no one here has ever had to deal with critics. As I say that with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, critics are always around, aren't they? That makes determination as a point of character all the more important to consider. These critics of Nehemiah then began to ridicule, as we read. They try to plant thoughts of doubt or concern, if not in Nehemiah's mind, then in the minds of the people, so that he would be ineffective. We read that in verse 19. What is it that you're doing? What do you think you're doing? Who are you? You can hear those kind of words ringing. Now, we covered this, as I mentioned, to the youth at the camps this summer especially, and they deal a lot with that in the schools. Schools have always been tough. They've gotten tougher. But when you do something different, like keeping God's holy days, or don't eat certain foods, or don't go to sporting events or dances on Friday night, or you're not involved in drugs or alcohol, you don't have to say anything. Just by your actions, you stand out. Kids will notice. But that's not limited to youth, as we see in Nehemiah's case. Family, co-workers, even people we might think are our friends can do the same things. Nehemiah sets a great example for us, though. In verse 20, he answers these critics and he says to them, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us, therefore we servants will arise." We. I don't think he was gesturing to them when he said this. "We will arise. We, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." You're not part of his family. You're not part of this city. You're not part of this nation. Why are you here? There's a time to be blunt with the critics. But because of Nehemiah's example, the people of Jerusalem are motivated to finish rebuilding the wall and reestablishing the gates. Because of Nehemiah's determination and publicly visible trust in God, the people rallied to the task at hand. We're going to jump ahead to chapter 4. Let's pick up the story in verse 6. It said, "So we built the wall," because chapter 3 talks about this building. And Nehemiah did something very interesting as well. He assigned families to work on certain sections of the wall. And in many cases, if you look, these were sections of the walls behind their house. All right? I don't care how Joe makes his wall, but I'm going to make the wall behind my house really strong. All right? There's some good psychology going on here. They're motivated to protect their families, which is right. And they all do this. And if all of them are doing it, then the whole wall is strong. So in chapter 4, verse 6, "We built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, now that the people had a mind to work." Now that they were motivated, now that they were focused, now that they had somebody supporting them. Half the height. That's better than nothing. That's better than broken down. But notice, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. All of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Now wait a minute, is God with them or not? It was one thing to have them throw these verbal assaults and to try to create doubt and so forth. Now they're gathering forces to physically harm them. But notice Nehemiah in verse 9, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night." This is a great example of faith and works. There was no doubting that God would take care of them, but they also recognized the responsibility they had to take care of themselves, to be prudent, if you will. And so then Verse 10, Judah says, the strength of the laborers is failing. There is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall, and our adversaries said they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill and cause the work to cease. And so it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Therefore, here's what Nehemiah does. I position men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, the leaders, and the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. Again, he's prudent here in saying we're going to protect those workers. Some will work on the wall. While they're doing so, they're going to be protected. And then at night, those gaps, as they're still open, will still be watched over. Verse 15, and it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half my servants worked at construction, while the other half held spears and shields and bows and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah, everybody working together, all of them determined to do the same thing. Those who built on the wall, those who carried burdens, loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and the other hand they held a weapon. They were not going to be caught by surprise. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the ones who sounded the trumpet was beside me, and so that if there was something that came up, they could be quickly rallied. Again, trusting in God, but doing their part. Notice back in verse 14, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your families. Nehemiah was a committed leader, and one of the very interesting things about a committed leader is that people will follow them. To continue the story here in Nehemiah, the critics then switched tactics again. They began with intimidation. They moved to threats of violence. They saw that that wasn't working. And when they saw the walls being rebuilt, the gates being restored, they went back to rumor mongering to try to intimidate them. Chapter 6 and verse 1. The same individuals. It happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall, that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors and the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come, let us meet together among the villages of the plain of Ono. They pretended to be their friends now. Oh, well, now that you've done all of that, I see what you're doing. Okay, well, let's come meet and talk. But notice Nehemiah has been given discernment here. They thought to do me harm. They were no more their friends now than they were previously. He knew that. And so then he said, verse 3, I sent messengers saying, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? I'm a little busy right now. Maybe we'll talk later. But they sent me this message 4 times. They were not easily dissuaded here. 4 times, it says. And I answered them in the same manner. And then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before the 5th time with an open letter. An open letter meaning anybody could read it. And they probably told others along the way, hoping that this would make or gather pressure against Nehemiah. And this is what was written in the letter, is reported among the nations. And Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. See, creating these rumors. I don't care if you have a letter from the king of Persia. You're doing this around about. You really plan to rebel. Once you have this restored, and you have appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to the king, so therefore come, let us consult together. If you don't come talk to us, we're going to go talk to the king. And then he sent, verse 8, saying, no such things are, as you say, are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. He's calling them on it. For they are trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done. Now, therefore, God, He goes back to God. Therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. You know, it's bad enough to have critics and people kind of sniping at you from the sides. But then in verse 9, we find something very sad. Verse 10. Individuals he thought were his friends that begin to do the very same thing. So he says, afterwards I came to the house of Shimeiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer. For some reason, he decided to throw his lot in with Sanballat, Tobiah, and the others. So he comes and says to Nehemiah, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you. You need to be safe. And the only place you can be safe, because there are no gates, remember. The walls are built, but there are no gates. So he's saying the only place you can be safe is if you hide in the temple. And so verse 11, Nehemiah says, should such a man as I flee? What is he saying there? This is bigger than me, he says. I'm not going to go hide in some corner. And who is there, such as I, who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Then I perceived, maybe not at first, but Nehemiah begins to see his intent, this man's intent. He said, I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because of Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way in sin, that he would compromise his integrity. After all that he had done to establish it and serve the people, if he had done this, it would have ruined any reputation that he had had. Because he says here that they may have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. What should our response be when friends try to get us to compromise? Sometimes they don't mean harm. They're not hired as such, if you will. But maybe we have friends in our neighborhood, at work, or whatever, and they say, well, it's not a big deal if you just come out one Friday night. You know, we're just going to be sitting, you know, listening to the band or in the bar or whatever it happens to be. Hold your place here. We're going to be back, but let's turn next to Proverbs. You and I have been set apart. Nehemiah was set apart. And God, as I mentioned in my introduction, is looking for individuals of character, individuals who have a determination for his way of life. That's not always easy or convenient. And it's not a way of life that we build on so that we have friends. Friends are good and they will come. Those that follow God, we'll see that here in a moment as well. But we need to be careful that those friends do not pull us off course. In Proverbs 1 and in verse 10, it says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Now that seems rather simplistic, doesn't it? But the bottom line is that we need to remember what we're supposed to be focused on. And the thing about sin, like any wrong behavior, is that once you do it, it becomes easier and easier and easier to continue in that. That's how habits are made. And as I've said to some recently, you know, at some point you have to put the shovel down and stop digging the hole. The godly character component of determination is a reminder to us that no matter what others may say or do, critics or supposed friends, we are to stay determined to do the right thing. Let's look next at Hebrews chapter 10. True friends, if they're truly friends and they care for our well-being, they want to see us succeed spiritually, true friends will not try to get us to compromise. Even if they truly believe it's the best for us, if they make a suggestion and we're resistant, they're not going to press the issue. God will show the right thing to us if we're close to God. Hebrews 10 and verse 24, we read this, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. We have to be close to God so that if a friend does say something that is trying to stir us to good works and to love, that we hear that person, that we can see past, if you will, something that might seem offensive. I mean, friends being friends, sometimes we can be rather blunt with each other. And maybe we hear the bluntness rather than what's being said behind the bluntness, to consider it. You know, even if somebody says the wrong thing in the wrong way, we have an obligation to think about what's being said in case there's value in it. So this aspect of stirring up one another. Let's go back to Nehemiah's example, Nehemiah 6. At the end of the story here, we see the net result, if you will, of Nehemiah's determination. What's the outcome of all of this? He had sought the king's favor to go back to Jerusalem. He'd asked for supplies to even help in the restoration. He motivated the leaders and by extension the people to rebuild the walls. He'd helped them to pay attention to the threats around them, to be safe, if you will, while they did this. And they had succeeded in rebuilding the walls and restoring the gates. And so in Nehemiah 6 and verse 15 it says, "So the wall was finished," he's summarizing here, "on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Now, we can read this story of Nehemiah and it may seem to drag out forever. You know, we might think, you know, he'd have to go get permits and he has to go get workers and he has to collect the supplies and, you know, months and months and months are dragging by and this may take, you know, a year or two or whatever. They've been decades and not making progress. But in 52 days, it says, they finished the wall, less than 2 months once Nehemiah showed up, once they were motivated properly, once they had the vision of determination. The city wall and gates had been, as I said, unrepaired for years and years with no progress. Through Nehemiah's determination and obviously God's blessing and the will of the people to follow Nehemiah's example, it was repaired in a very short time. What are you determined to accomplish in your spiritual life, even in your physical life? What could we accomplish as a church, as a local congregation, if we had this type of determination? Now, if you go back and look at some of the illustrations of those that have studied what few blocks are there, they know where the city wall was. They know how wide it was. And based on the width and other descriptions, they know roughly how high it was. They can look at that. We can go back and see that information. And they accomplished that in 52 days of rebuilding that, of removing the rubble. And if you go back and read the whole account, they had to build houses as well. Many of the houses weren't even built. So after Nehemiah motivated them to build the wall and they established the gates, he says, "We need the right houses for people to live here." So they did that as well. What could we accomplish with that same determination? Does Nehemiah's example inspire you? Or are we, like so many people in the world, tired and simply waiting for someone else to take care of the needs? Well, if someone else takes care of it, then they get to determine how it plays out, don't they? What lesson can you learn from what we've read today about Nehemiah? At the United Youth Camps, when we go through this material with the teens, every day we have a different memory verse, and there's a reason for that. It's not just to memorize a scripture to have. It connects to the theme of the day. The activity staff asks them to repeat it. Oftentimes it'll be a launch in a conversation before the activities. The counselors, as they're walking from activity to activity and through the course of the day, they'll go through it again, elaborating perhaps on some of the other aspects of Christian living or other things that have been added to that theme. Even when the campers gather in the evening for Christian living, or in some camps they call it fireside, in the evening to sort of recap the day, oftentimes a dorm or even the whole camp will be asked to recite the memory verse for the day. The verse picked for the particular day of this theme that we're covering today, this theme of determination, is Psalm 37. Let's look at that as we begin to wrap up here. Psalm 37 and in verse 4. we'll begin. It was actually two verses, verses 4 and 5. So Psalm 37, verses 4 and 5. This is a psalm of David, and he says, "Delight yourself also in the Eternal, and He shall give you the desires of your heart." Verse 5, "Commit your way to the Eternal, trust in Him also, and He will bring it to pass." Delight yourself. That's the knowing and doing what is right. Nehemiah delighted God. He asked God for favor before the king. God gave him that favor. He asked God for protection and for the people to be motivated, and God granted that. And so they rebuilt the wall. The temple was protected. It was safe. Those critics that had sought to harm Israel, they didn't want Israel to be a strong nation again. They didn't want them to be self-sufficient. They didn't want them to be in these safe environs of a wall protected by gates. They went away. In fact, if you go back and read the account, Nehemiah asked God to return unto them the same thing they wanted to do to Israel. Lastly, then, I'll leave you with a poem that I came across that I thought was very fitting for the message today. The author is unknown, but it goes like this. "Press on. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistent. Talent will not, for nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are important." That last line I really like. Persistence and determination alone are important alone. May we all be a people of godly character and determination.